or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky joins us to discuss health care reform and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Then we'll take you to AFGE's recent TSA Council 100 founding convention to hear from Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher and local presidents Rick McCoy and Kim Cranach-Lambert. Joined now by Jan Schakowsky, Congresswoman from Illinois. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got you here again at the Health Action Conference put on by Families USA. Tell us a little bit about your role today.
I thought that my role today was basically to say elections really matter. That, you know, we talk about health care, talk about the amazing progress we have made with the Affordable Care Act, but we want to make it even better. It's only possible if Barack Obama gets reelected, and frankly, if we take back the House and keep the Senate. We've seen the contrast. We passed the Affordable Care Act in the first 2 years. One of the greatest days of my life, March in 2010, that we actually established that health care in the United States of America is a right and not a privilege. Not a perfect bill, but a huge step forward. And then, as soon as the Republicans came in, repeal, repeal, repeal. Just take it all away.
You mentioned in the beginning here about maybe making the Affordable Care Act better, some improvements that you could do along the way. What do you think are some things that you would like to expand upon in this original act?
Well, you know, we were able to pass a public option in the House where people could actually choose a government-sponsored health care plan that would serve as an anchor to pull down prices and help to hold private insurance companies accountable. I think that we need to be able to negotiate, the Medicare needs to be able to negotiate with drug companies for lower prices like the Veterans Administration does. This would make government and individuals have more affordable prescription drugs. And frankly, I've always been a single payer person, kind of a Medicare for all Americans idea, and maybe down the road. But none of these improvements will be possible at all. We will be fighting to salvage something out of Medicare, out of Medicaid. I mean, these are programs they want to get rid of as we know them. We won't recognize our country, frankly, if the Republicans take charge in the White House.
If you got your wish and there was a single payer plan in this country, how would it change? How would health care change in America?
Well, first of all, right now we are paying per capita about almost twice as much as any other country for health care. Still, with 50 million people uninsured. It would be a lower cost system. We would have a lot of money to put it actually into health care. And it would eliminate all the fuss for people. People don't want a choice of insurance companies. They want a choice of doctors, of therapies. But, you know, picking among insurance companies, we're experiencing that already. Seniors are with the Medicare Part D plan. And so what a joy that would be to have one piece of paper in your life, and that would be your national health care card, and you could take it to the doctor or to the hospital and in some maybe even to the pharmacy and get what you need. It would just lift a huge burden of worry as well as cost off the shoulders of ordinary Americans. Now, of course, nothing's for free. We'd pay for it through a progressive tax system, hopefully made more progressive than it is. Maybe that top 1% would pay more of their fair share.
When you go back to your district and talk to your constituents, what are they saying to you about the Affordable Care Act?
Well, first of all, I have people practically crawling into my office every week saying, I hope I make it to my 65th birthday, and they'll point to parts of their body, you know, so I can get this done or that done or the other thing that really needs to be done. But I can't, there's no way that I can afford it right now. So what I hear is people are very worried. And, of course, the Republicans have been putting out this lie that the Democrats cut Medicare last time. And we'll see more ads about that. Well, in fact, what the Democrats did was stop the subsidizing of private insurance companies and saved a lot of money for Medicare, but we've actually improved Medicare. So people want the security of Medicare, and they want the security of just being able to have health care. My small businesses are just going crazy trying to provide health care or figuring out what to do with the one person they've hired that's sick.
When you talk to people about this, and maybe someone who might not agree or wasn't in support, and you break it down point by point, some of the things that they can benefit from, do you get a change in response from them? Are you able to change some minds about this?
Well, you know, there are some people, especially young people, who think, well, I shouldn't be forced to have insurance. But you know, that's the whole idea of being covered, is that, you know, if you have a motorcycle accident, or you know, you fall while you're out jogging, and you're pretty fit, then you will have the kind of coverage. And for young and healthy people, that coverage won't be very, very expensive. Even Republicans, this was actually a Republican idea, the mandate that everybody should be in the system and have to buy health insurance. So yes, there's some pushback, but you know, everybody is just one accident or one illness away from needing that health insurance.
And it has been reported upon a number of times that one accident or that one misstep can really lead to some dire financial straits for people. In fact, bankruptcies are often caused by some sort of health-related situation.
It's actually more than half of the personal bankruptcies are caused by health care. And that's why the president always said no one in the United States of America, the richest country in the world, should have to go bankrupt because they get sick.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from Illinois. Congresswoman, what's your main point here today that you're getting across to the attendees at the conference?
You know, these are, by and large, a group of progressives. And what I say to them is that you cannot sit on the sidelines. You cannot say, well, the president should have. Why didn't he? Not as good as it should be. Losing this election is not an option. We will not recognize this country if we do, and that everyone has got to be engaged right now in the congressional and the Senate and the presidential race.
So will you be taking time and devoting some of your efforts in 2012 to making sure that this is part of the political conversation, that people understand what's on the line?
Yes, I think health care is so central to everybody's life, and I think most people really get that. That I think one of the main messages will be, if you want health care for yourself and your family, then reelect Barack Obama and help us gain the House and keep the Senate.
And lastly, what's coming up in 2014, and how much work is going to be done to get to that point whenever that big rollout happens?
The states right now are in the process, they are supposed to be, of setting up these health care exchanges. And it's hard. I mean, the devil is definitely in the details, and legislatures are divided. But if the states do not set up their own exchanges, then the federal government will be prepared in 2014 to come in and do it for them. So if there's some reluctant governors or reluctant legislatures, fortunately, their people will not be deprived of the health care they need.
Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from Illinois, we always appreciate your time here.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher will join us to discuss voter protection during the upcoming election season.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined now by Bill Fletcher, the director of AFGE's Field Services and Education Department. Bill, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome back.
I'm always glad to be on the program, Jason.
And so here we are today at AFGE's TSA Council 100 Founding Convention. Set the scene for us here a little bit.
This has been a struggle for 10 years to gain the right to representation and collective bargaining for people that we all see. You know, every time we go into an airport, and we often take them for granted, they're often treated with a great deal of disrespect by both their management as well as many of the passengers. Yet these are the people who are on the line who are supposed to make sure that we're secure when we're flying. And so we finally gained some basic rights to collective bargaining. So today what's happening is the construction of what's called a bargaining council. And what that is in for our union is a collection of unions that have the same agency employer that are bargaining a master collective bargaining agreement, master agreement. And so the bargaining council is being constituted this week here in Las Vegas.
What are some key points of the master agreement that we should look forward to?
This is an interesting question, Jason, so I'm going to back up for a second. We were fighting for the TSOs, the screeners, the officers, to have full collective bargaining rights as per federal law. And when I say that, that the same rights that other federal employees have. For reasons that are very unclear, if not obscure, we only gain partial bargaining rights. So in addition to the reality that in a federal system you can't bargain over wages and benefits, there are certain other restrictions that have been imposed upon us. But I think that what's important to understand is that this is a beginning. And the way I look at it is like this, Jason. When the United Auto Workers bargained their first contract with General Motors, it was one page. And over the years, they were able to increase their power, increase the rights that they were able to win on behalf of their members. And I think we have to look at it the same way here, that we're just beginning. So there are certain issues around training and shift work and things like that. Shift work, you know, that is very important to bargain. But we have a long way to go. And I don't want anyone to be impatient about it.
So, in essence, we're looking at almost a living master agreement that will continue to evolve over time, over the years.
All agreements evolve, or they die. It's just like any other living creature. And so, yes, the difference here is that we're disappointed that we don't have full bargaining rights as per workers, let's say, in the VA or Social Security. But it is a beginning, and we're very optimistic about the future.
You have been a part of the labor movement for quite some time. How important is it that these TSOs have started this process, have at least some sort of collective bargaining rights now in place?
Oh, I think it's essential. I think what people often do not understand or do not get is that a union, the existence of a union, does not guarantee anything except one thing, which is the ability to bargain a collective agreement and the basis upon which people will be respected. That's what it guarantees. Everything else depends on the relative power of a group, the support that they have in a community, things like that. So the fact that the TSOs committed themselves 10 years ago with the help of AFGE to do this is very, very significant.
To your point then, how important will it be going forward to organize as many workers as possible?
Critically important. When you have a low percentage of your workforce unionized, you're treated as weak. You're disrespected. When, however, you have your workforce highly unionized, the employer has to take you very seriously. And we see this in the federal system. I mean, for example, the Bureau of Prisons, which I believe is 95% unionized. And this is in a situation where it's what's called open shop. Workers don't automatically become members of the union. So they have to make that decision. The Bureau of Prisons component of AFG is very well respected. And you contrast that with other parts of even our same union where the percentage of members is very low. And that translates into weaker collective bargaining agreements.
And then furthermore, the ability to have representatives on Capitol Hill makes you even stronger there as well, correct?
Precisely, because since we can't bargain over wages and benefits, the bargaining takes place with Congress. And therefore, if we do not have the forces, Congress knows that. Because it's not just about numbers, it's also about how you're perceived in a community. If you're perceived, well, if you're even known to exist is the first point. But if you're known to exist but nevertheless are not perceived as being particularly strong, you're not going to get support. People in general do not like to support those who aren't prepared to fight. You know, it's like this story that I've been telling a lot, Woody Allen's story, about this woman who has a son who's a boxer. So she goes to this boxing match, and he's fighting, and he is getting pummeled. And she's sitting next to this priest, and she says, "Father, Father, please pray for my son, pray for my son." He says, "I will pray for your son, but it would help if he would fight." That's the critical thing. People will support you if they see that you're fighting.
So knowing that today is the first step in a long journey and that this will evolve over time, what's a realistic goal to expect coming out of this week?
I'm going to defer on that question only for this reason. The bargaining has not formally started yet, so I don't want to get too far ahead. I would say at a more general level this, that we need to come out of this round of negotiations having captured the respect of management. That's what we have. We have to come out of this round of negotiations having gained the interest and support of wider sections of the public. We have to come out of this round of negotiations having debunked many of the obscene attacks on TSOs that come largely from ultra-conservatives. That's what I would say.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher. Bill, 2012 figures to be a very important year in terms of elections politically. And one of the key issues that you and your department are working on is voter rights and voter suppression. Tell us what's happening there.
Well, the main department in AFG that is leading this is the Women and Fair Practices Department, and so we're supporting that. And this is so important as an issue, because what we've been noticing ever since the 2000 elections were stolen, 2000 presidential elections, is an erosion of our basic right to vote and to have true democratic elections. So, for example, 2000 was stolen. In 2004, there were a series of problems in the state of Ohio with voting that revolved around voting machines that may very well have thrown the election to Bush. Then what we started to see after 2006 is this developing wave or tsunami of conservative attacks on voting rights. And what's important, Jason, for people to understand is that in this country, we have been engaged in a fight since the very beginning to expand voting rights, to make it easier for people to vote. There are ultra-conservative forces at work in Congress particularly, but also in state legislatures, that are trying to restrict, to shrink the electorate, that are, in fact, trying to eliminate people from voting. And so what's happened is that that's moved from the realm of rhetoric to the realm of legislation and executive orders. So, for example, I'll give you a couple of instances. You have situations where people are losing the right to early voting. Now, early voting has been a very important reform because it basically means that people are no longer restricted to that particular Tuesday in November, but they have a little bit more time to participate. Very, very important for the elderly, very important for people that have that work maybe double shifts, more than one job. So that's one example. There's another example that's related to that, where certain states are trying to eliminate Sunday voting. Now, the question is, why would you eliminate Sunday voting? And when these legislators are asked about that, they start mumbling. Basically, they can't come up with a coherent response. But the real response is that this is being driven largely by hard right-wing Republicans who believe that there are certain constituencies that are more likely to vote Democratic that they wish to exclude. Now, those constituencies range. It could be the elderly, the young, people of color, union members. It could be any number of constituencies. And so instead of voting becoming easier, it's being restricted. Now, we have to understand that this is not unprecedented in this country. And the last time we had this on a massive scale, this country suffered for decades. That was in the late 1800s and early 1900s, when in the aftermath of the period known as Reconstruction, there was a massive disenfranchisement in the South of African American and poor white voters. This was a point when they instituted poll taxes, when they instituted literacy tests in order to vote. And what happened was that the number of voters shrank, and you ended up having, in essence, one-party rule in most of the South, eliminating wholesale millions of people from being able to vote. We're facing a very dangerous situation that's quite analogous.
So how then will AFGE be fighting back on this issue?
Well, one of the things is that we're joining with other unions and other community-based organizations in raising awareness on this, making sure that voters have the requisite identification that they need, because part of what's happening with a number of these states is that they are saying that there's only government identification that will be acceptable in order to vote. So as opposed to the old days where, you know, you could show up student ID or you could show up with a utility bill, now it's only certain kinds of identification. Well, we have to make sure that everyone has these. What we also have to make sure is that if this election is stolen, in addition to being prepared to mount all sorts of challenges via litigation, we have to make sure that we do not have a repeat of what happened in Florida in 2000. In Florida in 2000, after the election was stolen, the people that were the Gore supporters were demobilized. They did almost nothing except collect affidavits, whereas the Bush supporters were able to frame the issue as if the Gore people were sore losers, as if they had been the real winners. And they mounted very well orchestrated media events to make it appear that they were the ones defending democracy as opposed to that they were the thieves. We have to make sure that if the election is stolen, we have people in the streets. We cannot sit back and simply say, well, hey, things happen.
You mentioned awareness. Do you think people realize that this is an issue?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Because a lot of this has been a stealth operation carried out by Republican legislators. And so unless you are really focused on the goings-on in your state house, a lot of this you're just going to miss. The other reason is something that I'll say is very controversial, which is that many white people think that this is not an issue that will have any effect on them. They think that this is really an issue about what happens to black voters and Latino voters, as opposed to that this is an issue of democracy. This is a basic issue of democratic rights. And even though disproportionately people of color will be hurt by this, this is not just about eliminating voters of color. This is about eliminating voters who the Republicans perceive as potential supporters of Democratic candidates.
Bill, you are a well-known author. We had you on once before to talk on our sister program, Inside Government TV, about Solidarity Divided.
Yes.
But you are due to put out another book here this year. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you for asking. So Beacon Press is publishing a book of mine called They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. And what this is a book that's directed at people that don't know much about unions, but have been very much influenced by corporate television, corporate media. So they called me and they asked me to write this, and I was very excited about it. And what helped me writing this book, what helped me in the writing of this book, was about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I was on a plane from San Jose to San Diego. And I was sitting next to this young woman who's probably in her 30s. And I was reading this book about global labor unions and things. And she was like very curious about what was I reading. So she just asked me. So, you know, I explained it to her. She nodded her head and she said to me, "What is a union?" And at first I thought, is she messing with me? And then I realized she was absolutely serious. So I composed myself, and then I began to explain what a union was. And I realized she had no idea what I was talking about, even with the explanation. She had no idea. I wrote this book for her. She was clearly not stupid, and she was also not a kid. But unions were not on her screen at all.
Why do you think that in some walks of life there are no explanations of unions, that it's not something that's talked about very regularly?
A few reasons. One is that we've decreased as a percentage of the workforce since the 1950s. In the 1950s, 1960s, even if you weren't in a union, you knew what a union was. I mean, you had to have been on some obscure island somewhere in the South Pacific not to know, right? And even then, there was probably AFG there, right? But as we've declined as a percentage of the workforce, it becomes easier not to know. A second reason is that employers in this country have, for the most part, been very hostile to unions. And to the extent to which they influence the media, you know, in the United States, we have the best media money can buy, as they say, you know. And so to the extent to which they can influence that, unions are less and less referenced. And when they are, they're often referenced in a negative way. You know, they talk about corruption or the mob or the unions are greedy, that type of thing. And rarely do you have a counter-argument. Newspapers, for example, used to have labor editors or a union reporter. And that's virtually vanished. It's been, you know, it went through stages and now it's basically collapsed into the business section. So it's not there.
What's it going to take to bring the conversation of union back to the forefront?
My book will become a national bestseller.
As you look forward here in 2012, what are you hoping to accomplish at AFGE?
Let me give you a serious answer to your question, and then I'll get to that. What's it going to take? I think that unions have to certainly be more aggressive in organizing, but we have to rethink unions. We have to rethink the job of the union. The union should be an instrument for economic justice and not simply an instrument for bettering people who happen to be in a union. to the extent to which a union is fighting for economic justice, we will win supporters. I mean, there was a time in this country when even if you weren't in a union, you knew unions were the right thing to support. And we've lost that. We have to regain that. So in 2012, I'm hoping that we make some steps in that direction. I'm hoping in 2012 that by November, we're able to decisively defeat these backward elements, in backward political elements that want to repeal the 20th century and basically take us back to 1898. I'm hoping that this being a convention year for AFG, that we come out of the convention with an energized leadership that has a very clear and aggressive vision of massive organizing in the federal sector, but also of building a broad consensus among unions and our allies that the public sector is essential, we can't afford to lose it, that we need the public sector and we need public space. If we come out with those things, I'll be quite happy.
Bill Fletcher, AFGE's Field Services and Education Department Director. Bill, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Local 777 President Rick McCoy joins us from the TSA Council 100 Founding Convention.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined again now by Rick McCoy, the president of AFGE's TSA Local 777 out of Illinois and Wisconsin. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's always good to be here. I appreciate you offering.
Rick, this is an exciting time for you as a TSO. Here we are at the AFGE TSA Council 100 Founding Convention. Set the scene for us here today.
Oh, it's crazy, man. The atmosphere, everybody happy, ecstatic. You know, we got everybody that helped us from day one, you know, membership and organization, field services and education. So it's good to see everybody, and it's good to know we finally here. This is what everybody talked about like 6 years ago, and to see it actually come to fruition is just great. It's great.
Talk about that a little bit, how this impacts you personally after all the work that you've done to get to this point to be at the TSA Founding Convention here with AFGE.
I mean, it's crazy because, you know, I've been through all this stuff with my family, taking my kids everywhere I go, and to actually be a part of something that's like history. I mean, 44,000 individuals getting collective bargaining, and then the former council. We all know how strong AFG councils are. So for us to have one as TSA, it kind of like puts us up there with the big boys, but we understand we still are youngsters of the group. But, I mean, it's great, man.
What's the morale like at your local 777 now that AFGE is the exclusive representative of you all?
It's, you know what? It's kind of hard to gauge because our local has really got so young because TSA is only hiring part-timers. People that's been there from day one, 2002, everybody walking around with their chest stuck out because we've been waiting on this. But our youngsters, we have to educate them because they don't even know the significance of it. They just hear unions and see unions, but they don't know they're part of one of the strongest unions in the world. So, but the morale is good as far as officer-wise, but union-wise, we still got to educate those guys, let them know the work not done yet.
Rick, what are some of the issues that you're facing on a day-to-day basis at the job site?
Oh, just management now, because everything is official. Management seem to think that we're taking their power away, which they never had any power. But now since, you know, because I got a position, me and Kim Kronak out of Pittsburgh, the national lead stewards. It's only two positions. So when you go to these airports outside of O'Hare, outside of Midway, outside of Milwaukee, these FSD staff, they think you're coming in to be like a bully or something. But you have to service your members first. So, you know, it's not really... It's actually smoother than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be like the battle line drawing. But they just doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes. So we just have to stay in touch with the GCO, stay in touch with our local lawyers and things of that nature, and let them know what they're doing.
What will you be focusing on as a national lead steward for AFGE?
Representation. I mean, the way our determination was read and the way it was written, our main focus has to be the representation of its members. I mean, it's a lot of travel involved in it, going from state to state. But the main thing is the representation of the members. Everything else will come. But if we don't lay that groundwork foundation of representing our members, we're going to be in some trouble.
Now, one of the key issues that we know about at TSA is the pay-for-performance pay model, yeah. PASS. Tell us where that stands today.
Well, as it stands today, we get to negotiate it. We get to bargain it. But PASS is just outright horrible. You figure a guy like me that's been here for 10 years, I've never got less than quote-unquote role model. But, I mean, it's a bonus. It's not a raise. Bonuses get taxed. If you get a $4,000 bonus, you're only going to see like $2,700. They give you a 1% increase. I don't really like that because you can have an individual that's really doing what they're supposed to do. You can have a person that's just standing on the side, and they'll get the same thing. You know, they got to do something better. I think once we get to the table, because Lord knows we've researched that PASS up and down, so we're ready to get to the table and try to knock that out.
What do the employees say about PASS? What do your colleagues say about it?
Well, they hate it. Unless, if you have an individual that's been at TSA for a year and a half, they love PASS because they actually wasn't a part of the initial grading course, so they get like $1,500. So they think that's a lot of money. After they've been there 2-3 years, they hate PASS because that $1,500 turns into 500, and you know, it's just, you can't even gauge it. TSA can't even gauge it. There's no way we could honestly come to the table and say, this year I'm going to get $4,000. You can't do it.
Are you comfortable, are the workers comfortable being graded very subjectively in the way that PASS does?
No, we're not comfortable because even now, as we speak, as we're getting ready to bargain this historic contract, TSA has actually taken the first step. They've taken the first step process of PASS from your immediate supervisor. The person that has to grade you for 85% of the PASS score, they can't be the immediate first step. It goes to the manager. So, I mean, it's just so subjective. You can't gauge it, Jason. You can't.
What are some of those other issues that you're working on? I know in the past there were some difficulties with uniform requirements and things like that. What are some other things that you have going on?
Oh, the most thing we're working on now is, like, scheduling because with the with collective bargaining coming up now across the United States, management, they pretty much froze shift bids and things of that nature. And when officers ask about them, they'll say, well, we can't do this because the union won't allow us to do it. You can't change your shift and things of that nature. It's just real quirky stuff, stuff that they've been doing underwater for so long. Now it's starting to surface, and they're just blatantly doing stuff and blaming it on the union. That's the biggest problem.
So do you see the union coming in and really sort of shedding some light on some of those practices that happened in the past?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where the education part comes in at, because a lot of stuff that we do on a regular basis, AFG does a good job of getting that paperwork out to those people who are in the network. But then it's up to the members and activists at the airport to shed that light even further and go give it to a non-member and say, hey, do you know this is what we're doing right here? Because TSA will take the credit for anything and everything.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE TSA Local 777 President Rick McCoy. Rick, what's your top goal here at the conference this week?
I have a lot of goals. My top goal is to make sure that all the TSA individuals that's here for the council understand that representation has to play a top priority, as well as organizing. We got the contract negotiations together, but we still don't have enough members nationwide to really be a bully. If you get 44,000 people the right to collectively bargain, and you don't have 20,000 signed up as yet, something wrong with that, and we can't allow that to happen, because then we leave the administrator, we leave him off the hook, because now he can literally say, well, I don't know if y'all are speaking for everybody, which he came to my airport and said that in the town hall meeting.
When you go out and organize, what are the key issues that you put in front of potential members?
Representation, first of all, trying to get a better performance from management trickling down to the members and the officers in general. See, our contract is so unique once it's done, because we really don't have to represent people that's not a member of the union, which is unprecedented. I don't think there's no other federal agency that does that. They have to at least represent somebody through the first step of the grievance. So we have to make sure these members and officers understand how important it is to be a part of this union. Because with TSA, everything's so goofy. We don't even know if the administrator, we don't know if he's going to be here after the next administration. So we got to get what we can to carry over until they do something else.
So you're really looking at it then from a long-term perspective to get what you can get and have it last for as long as possible?
Absolutely. And keep building on it. You're absolutely right, Jason. You're absolutely right.
And so how have you been received by potential members? Do you find that people are coming around now a little bit to the idea of being part of the union?
Yeah, you know, 5 years ago, somebody saw Rick McCoy, Don Evans, LaDonna. They run it. Here come the union people. Now, since everything's official, they come looking for us. You know, you get calls at like 12 o'clock midnight. Y'all need you to come to the airport right now. It's 12 o'clock in the morning. So you got to call that manager and things of that nature. So they starting to come around slowly, but we need it at a more rapid pace, though.
Rick, you've given a lot of your time and your energy to the labor movement, particularly your fellow TSOs. Why is this such an important issue for you? Why are you so dedicated to the union?
Well, I'm from a union family. You know, my dad's side pretty much Teamsters, and my mom's side federal, VA, Social Security, things of that nature. So I'm from a union background. But to work for TSA and have somebody tell you that you can't collectively bargain when you was raised under a collective bargaining, it's just something that you have to fight for. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand, you know, civil rights, labor rights, that stuff was done by young people with the emphasis on our elders watching us, making sure we go the right way. So I got to do my part, because I don't want the people before me to think that I'm just one of these guys out here. He in the federal service, he don't care. You know, we have to do what we got to do to provide everything for the people that's coming behind us.
Every time I talk to you, it seems like things just keep getting better and better for you and your fellow TSOs. What are you looking forward to most in 2012?
Honestly speaking, the signing of the contract. Because a lot of people, I mean, that's a real big deal, but that's not the end of the trip. You know, once this contract is signed, we have to make sure that it's carried out by management. We're going to do what we got to do. But I'm just, the negotiating of this contract and the bargaining, it's a whole lot of hoopla. And people got to understand that it doesn't stop there. Once we get that thing signed, once we get it acclimated, we got to keep moving. And that's the energy that I'm trying to bring this week, to let everybody know this was coming. We knew this was going to happen, so let's keep striving forward. And that's it.
Rick McCoy, our good friend, AFGE Local President 777 out of Illinois and Wisconsin. Rick, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Jay. I appreciate it, man.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll come back to the AFGE TSA Council 100 Founding Convention with Local 332 President Kim Cranach Lambert.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members.
The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined again by Kim Cranach Lambert, the local president of AFGE's TSA 332 out of Pittsburgh. Kim is also the deputy lead national steward for the TSA Council 100. Kim, welcome back to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful, Kim. And I suspect you're pretty well today, too, as we're here at the founding convention of TSA Council 100. Set the scene for us.
It's very exciting that we have probably 150 delegates here representing our locals nationwide, and this has been 9 years in the making, and it's exciting, and everybody's happy to be here.
What are you hoping to accomplish this week at the convention?
Set up our council, what the bylaws are going to be for the council, following the Constitution, and starting to work as a body for the TSA locals nationwide.
You had mentioned that this is 9 years in the making. How important is it to be here on this day, the founding convention for TSA Council 100?
To me, it's exciting because it has been 9 years and I've been doing it that long. Considering they said we'd never have a union, considering they said that we would never have collective bargaining, it's all finally happening. Everything's falling into place. It's a little slow at times, but we're moving forward and we're excited about it.
So what have been some key issues along the way? I mean, you had mentioned, again, 9 years that this has been in the making. What are some key issues along the way that you have faced as a TSO?
The fact that everybody interprets nationwide, the biggest problem is, I think, when TSA was established, it was supposed to be consistency across the board. And the problem is, still after almost 10 years, it's inconsistency because the airports interpret the policies any way that they need to, and so our officers are faced with trying to juggle what they're supposed to be doing and what the policy says, and it's not easy and it's not simple, and it's been a difficult time in the past 9 years of that.
When you talk to TSOs at your airport in Pittsburgh or your colleagues here at the convention, what seems to be the top concern that they have as an employee at TSA?
I believe that they just want to be treated like any other federal employee, which has been our goal for almost a decade now, and to have every right and benefit that any other federal employee has. And we just want to be treated as a regular federal employee because we work hard every day, and our objective is to serve our country. And that's why everybody joined TSA.
So many times we've heard in our discussions how TSA was one agency that just wasn't afforded the same rights as other agencies, other federal employees. Why do you think that it took so long for this to come around and be where it is today?
Well, I think if President Bush would have set up the agency like any other federal agency, that we wouldn't have wasted 10 years of trying to catch up to every other federal agency and be treated like any other federal employee. We've wasted a lot of time, energy, and money just trying to be equal. So I think that's our biggest issue. We're finally going to be able to sit at the table in a couple weeks and negotiate our first contract, and that's extremely exciting.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Kim Cranach Lambert, the local president of AFGE's TSA 332 out of Pittsburgh. Kim, you're also the deputy lead national steward for Council 100. What are some of the responsibilities that come with that position?
We're to represent everybody nationwide. So we have people, Ricky and myself, have people calling us local presidents from all over the country. So any issues that we can help them with, we try to. Actually, myself, I've been invited to TSA headquarters and represent AFGE on the National Advisory Council that they have and the Diversity Council that they have at headquarters. In December, I was there because it was classified as a formal discussion, which was kind of exciting. And now that I've just been elected on the National Advisory Council. So I'll be have a dual status. I'll be a member of the National Advisory Council and represent AFGE. So we're sitting at the table and we're a part of whatever's going on. So that's exciting.
Kim, talk about your relationship with management, not just at your home airport in Pittsburgh, but also on the national level now.
I have a very good relationship with my management in Pittsburgh. I think we've set it up that the labor management should be positive and it shouldn't be adversarial because it serves no purpose. So if we work together, we can have common goals and come up with solutions. And I'm trying to do that nationwide. So when I am meeting with the directors of the different departments at TSA, I'm trying to show them that we have a common goal, which is to take care of our folks nationwide.
At your home airport, you mentioned that you have a pretty good relationship. So management sees your point of view and understands your concerns that exist in the workplace?
That is correct. And I'm fortunate enough that my FSC tells TSA headquarters that our positive relationship, and I also, which is a good thing. And I think that sets a good example for everybody on both sides.
Now, we know that during the last several years, the pass pay system has been an issue. Where does that stand today?
Our objective is when we negotiate the contract is to get rid of pass. We're going to see how that goes. That's what our people would like. And you know that federal employees have had their wages frozen for the past 2 years. So I think TSA is hurting more than any other federal employee because we are the lowest paid federal employees in the government.
What is it about the pass system that employees just can't get behind?
The fact that it's subjective. Your supervisor might not even work with you, who is rating you. I think some of the supervisors really have no business rating anybody because they don't do the job or can't do the job themselves. The fact that you work all year long, you take the tests, you do all the things you're supposed to do, and the money's not there. It's not fully funded. So it's kind of discouraging if you get an excellent score and you're getting a 1% or 2% increase. The money should be out ahead of time. You should know what you're striving for.
Do you think that if this system were abolished, that maybe the employee morale would increase?
I do believe it would increase, and I do believe that the TSA wants to be under the GS system or something along those lines to where they know what they're going to get every year, because the first couple years of TSA, we didn't get any raises whatsoever.
You have been a TSO for quite some time. You know what the job entails, but many people outside of the airports don't know what you all face every day. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a TSO and some of the things that you face on a day-to-day basis.
I think in general that a TSO or a BDO, because I'm actually a BDO now.
Behavioral Detection Officer,
and I love doing that job. But the average TSO has to deal with the public, which the media feeds the public to be nasty with us. So they have to deal with the public. They have to deal with the managers or supervisors or leadership that are doing whatever they want to do. It's not really a very good environment. It's very hard on them. You're on your feet all day long. And then you read the newspaper or you're watching the news and you have our congressional people bashing us, what I think is very unprofessional because they are supposed to be supporting us. And they should be doing what we do and serve their country, and they should be supporting us 100% like any other federal employee.
Now, after this convention concludes and you make your way through 2012, what will your top priority be?
Is to negotiate, because I'm on the negotiating team, a first-rate contract for TSA, and I'm extremely excited about that. And just to make sure that everything is consistent nationwide and then our TSA employees are taken care of, because that's the objective.
Kim Kranek-Lambert, the local president of AFGE's TSA 332 out of Pittsburgh and the deputy lead national steward for AFGE Council 100. Kim, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to our guest this week, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, AFGE Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher, and TSA Local Presidents Rick McCoy and Kim Kranak-Lambert. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.